Thank you, Emilia, for inviting me. I'm really not in this particular field. So I will show you something really different. So very beginning today is my laptop, and I hope I will really don't have any technical problem for this presentation. So I will discuss about the non-optical nanoscale functional imaging to study living cells, in particular cardiomyocytes, because the question, the relationship between the structure and function of cardiomyocytes are very, very important. So first of all, the first step of any study is observation. And we have from one point of view, we have an optical microscopy, and optical microscopy has a limitation of diffraction limit of light, but we cannot just resolve any surface structure with optical microscopy. From another point of view, this we have some sort of high resolution techniques, but high resolution techniques for the fixed cells. And potentially this, what I'm doing, I'm just really working with the scanning ion conductance microscopy, which is the filling the gap between the optical microscopy and electron microscopy, and scanning ion conductance microscopy, the technique for studying the living cells with the high resolution. So potentially this is a part of the scanning probe microscopy, and as a probe we use the glass micropipette as a people for the patch clamp, and the diameter of our pipette is varies from the several nanometers to the 200, 300 nanometers to 400 nanometers, depends on the idea of the experiments. So we probe the surface of the alive cells. So potentially this is my old system just when I started 18 years ago. This is the two pieces and just potentially the petri dish with the alive cells. This is the scanning part. This is a CD camera, old one. This is a homemade confocal, and this is a patch clamp. And now this we combine everything with everything for study cardiac physiology. So potentially this how it works is just we measure the current between two electrodes, one inside pipette, one in the solution, and we use the electronic feedback control which keeps the distance between the pipette always constant, and potentially this we measure current together with the Z displacement of our pipette and produce the topographical map of the alive cells. So potentially this we start from the simple cells with the kidney cells, and the idea was to compare our functional measurement with the scanning electron microscopy images, and we start work with the kidney cells many years ago, and we just found we can resolve the border zone of the cells, we can resolve the microvilli, and potentially this our image is comparable with the scanning electron microscopy, but using our software we can just really measure the volume of the cells, height of the cells, because this is a live image. So potentially what we can do, we can just, this is just our old stuff, when we just really see this, if you have some sort of mutation in the protein of the cytoskeleton, you can just see this in the surface, abnormal bundle of actin.
Is the cell system just cells growing on a petri dish?
This is in a petri dish, yeah, because this is in a petri dish, but potentially now with our new modification, we can just scan the tissue, we can scan the open aorta, we can scan the, for example, a cardiac slice together with the different things. I will show you. This is some sort of beginning, because it's first we just really get this is So potentially this from the constant feedback control, now this we do in the Hawking probe when the our pipette hope from the some sort of fixed distance, and in this situation we can just do the something thick objects. For example, we can just see the this is the cells in the collagen matrix, and we can just resolve the, with the high resolution the collagen fibers. And potentially now this we can scan the tissues. This is old stuff with organ corti, and this is electron microscopy image. But potentially this what interesting, we can just do the in-life imaging. So potentially this is cells, epithelial cells, and the normal situation, this is cell number one, number two, number three, and we can just add any stimulus, for example, hypertonic medium stress and hypertonic medium stress, and see, watch the cells after the addition of any stimulus. So potentially, and check the volume, check the how the contact really form, how the, for example, the contact of epithelial cells. This is observed as some sort of balloon. But very interesting, we can just scan long-term study of living cells, and this is our kidney cells during the 24 hours, and we can just watch how cells can divide, how cells can differentiate, and how the cells can communicate each other. This is some sort of physiological situation in the these cells in the petri dish, but without any stimulus. And for example, this one, the skin cells without calcium, and we can just, when we add the calcium, we can just see this, how junctions form between these three cells, five cells, and potentially this, we can just after that use this frame by frame and calculate a lot of parameters in alive cells. And this time, just I start to think this what the important surface structure of the different type of cells. And a long time ago, so when we start with the kidney cells, we found the different type of cells have the different surface structure, and this is really related to the different signaling molecules on the surface of the different type of cells. And we start our journey from again from the kidney cells, and we found that in the surface of the kidney cells we have a lot of microvilli, and this microvilli is not really rigid structures. They have the cycle of the 12 minutes, so they can form, they can have a steady state and retraction. And people know that in the top of the microvilli there's a lot of receptors and channels distribute, and potentially, oh, again, it's just it means all receptors and channels in these cells can just change during this cycle. So from this time, I start to think about this idea that channels and receptors distribute not randomly on the surface of the different cells. So with our technique, we can just detect the different surface structure. Now our resolution is quite high, around 13 nanometers, and potentially this we can just scan and detect the clathrin-coated pits, how they open and close, and just potentially this image in this 9 second per frame, and we can just really match how just really clathrin-coated pits take part in the different process on the surface. And also important things in the compartments part, the cavioli like structures, and this I will in the main part of my talk I will discuss about signalosomes in cavioli, and how we can detect this cavioli, and why we're just looking for cavioli like structures, because with our pipette we can detect cavioli in the surface, and cavioli are very, very important for cardiomyocytes, and cavioli, this is a signalosomes which just can concentrate a lot of channels and receptors, especially in cardiomyocytes. So advantages of scanning microscopy itself, some just scan the surface of live cells with high resolution, study changes of the topography, measure cell volume, and study the dynamic of cell surface structure. But, okay, this is, was just beginning, how it's related to cardiomyocytes. From my postdocs, I just scan a lot of different cells from the neuronal synapses to sperm cells to epithelial cells. But my favorite cells is the cardiomyocytes, because the cardiomyocytes is very structured cells. And yesterday this we discussed about the T-tubules. Yesterday we discussed about how T-tubules important in the signaling. So this is a scan of the small part of the cells with the high resolution. And in this small part in the cells, we can detect the T-tubule open areas, sarcomeric structure, and the Z grooves. And when we just see the electron microscopy, we can just see this how this related. So this is a T-tubules area, this is a Z line, and this is our scan. How we can just study the structure of the cardiac cells. But in my lab now, we're just really looking for some structural microdomains, and my main goal and aim to understand how the beta-adrenergic receptor and L-type calcium channels located in the cardiomyocytes and cardiomyocytes in the normal situation, and the cardiomyocytes from disease models, from disease patients, and why it's important. So potentially this we just looking for the T-tubules open areas, for the we just named this between the T-tubules we see the crest. In the crest we can just detect the cavioli-like structures, and in the end of the cells we have an intercalated disc. So potentially this I try to answer this question already 13 years, and I think it's I will do it in the end of my scientific career. So just how signaling microdomains are organized and where are they located, what is the relationship between the structure and function in this compartment, and how this compartment change during the heart failure, and do changes in structure of compartment in heart failure affect their function. When I start to study the cardiomyocytes, we just do the simple experiment, we scan the cells, and after that do some physiological measurement. So first of all, this we just check this how we can just detect how good structure the in cardiomyocytes and compare this we name this Z groove index, how theoretical Z groove the ratio with the just visible Z groove in the scan, and how this is related between the T-tubule index, and we just find the main things because as we are working with the heart failure model of 16 weeks of coronary ligation rats, and we found just structurally we have differences in the surface and differences in the T-tubules, and this related to some function. But we use the different population of the cells, half of population we just do the structural things, half of population functional things, and we found the differences in calcium sparks and calcium transient. And when we go for the human cells, we just really found the cells from the dilated cardiomyopathy, ischemic heart disease, and obstructive cardiomyopathy just have differences in the T-tubule ratio and the groove ratio, have also differences in contraction. But it was really something what I wanted to change, and I wanted to study structures and function in one goal. And during these 13 years, we have some sort of combination of scanning with a lot of functional technique. So potentially, we use the scanning itself. We just combine the scanning ion conductance microscopy with confocal microscopy. When we position the laser beam from the confocal microscopy to the pipette, and we can in one goal see the distribution of topographical map and any fluorescent particles. I will show you in the minutes what we can do. So our second combination, what we just really developed in 2010, we just really decided to study the localization of the life receptors in the surface, and we scanning, combined scanning together with the FRET technique, and see this how localized the beta adrenergic receptor signaling is. Also, we can use our pipette as a pressure jet, apply the pressure through the pipette, and in this situation, our diameter of the pipette a little bit bigger than the normal scanning, and in this situation, we just apply the pressure, and we just measure the compliance and stiffness of the membrane, and we combine this technique with the optical recording, and just for study the mechanical just improvement of the calcium propagation for entire cells. So another thing, because we developed the angle scanning in conductive microscopy, we can scan, but scan not vertically, scan with the angle, and in this situation you can resolve the intercalated disc, and in this situation you can just really see the topography of intercalated disc and measure the any ion channels, because the main application of our technique, this is a super resolution scanning pitch clamp, when we just measure the single ion channels from the different microdomain, structural microdomain of cardiomyocytes. So with this, just I start to discuss surface confocal. So potentially, yesterday was really very interesting talk about 3D reconstruction of T-tubules. Potentially, this, if we have a surface confocal setup, we can just see the opening of the T-tubules, and we can just load the cells with the ANOPS, and we in one goal see this how the ANOPS ANOPS staining corresponds to the opening, and after that switch off the feedback control and do the 3D reconstruction of confocal images. But also what we can do, we can just apply the ANOPS dye through the pipette and map the single individual T-tubules and see how deep the T-tubules in the different situation with the disease and without disease. Also, a long time ago, this, we just found the way to study the contraction and calcium dynamic in one goal using the neonatal cardiomyocytes, stem cells derived cardiomyocytes, when we just really focus our pipette in the center of the cells and measure the vertical displacement of our pipette together with calcium. And in this situation, we can just use this model for the different drug screening. So for the situation when we have some sort of GFP tact, or we can just really see, for example, here the image of cavioli and the some sort of fluorescent cavialin RFP staining, and you can see this how we can match it, because it's green one, this is from confocal 200 nanometers, and this red dot, this is our scanning 50 nanometers holes. And also this now this we are studying the relationship between the myofibroblasts and cardiomyocytes, and this is a physical contact between these two cells, and this is how just connexin 43 can distribute between this contact. So potentially the advantages of the surface confocal study, the T-tubule network structure inside cardiomyocytes, and topography of the same cells, study distribution of fluorescent labeled receptor protein on the surface, and study contraction and calcium dynamic of the different not mature cardiomyocytes. So, okay, so just I will now start from the real. Yeah, this is also another application with the with the compliance stuff. This we just really found the when we just try to do the combination of optical recording and the stiffness measurement, because potentially when you have a good structured cells, when you apply the mechanical stimulus, you just really in the situation, in the CREST application, you don't have any response. When you apply mechanical stimulus to the groove, you can see the small calcium propagation. And when you apply the mechanical stimulus to the failing cells, you have your propagation last very, very long, and potentially this, in this situation we can just use this for localization of pressure application and studying Hammer electrical transduction with possibility to understand initiation of arrhythmic event and measure cardiomyocytes membrane compliance. Now we start to map, mechanic map of the different cardiomyocytes when we apply the constant pressure during scanning, and we can just see this some sort of microdomain, mechanic microdomain on the different type of cardiomyocytes with different disease. But my main interest and what we're doing now in my work, we just study the localization of the and special distribution of the ion channels and receptors in cardiomyocytes. The main direction of my lab, so we study the localization of beta adrenergic receptors, and we just try to answer the question about the localization of beta adrenergic receptor in the surface of the cardiomyocytes and during disease. So because the beta adrenergic receptors, because they have a different function, and potentially this people thought about the different localization in the surface, but potentially this we found a way how to just catch the alive functional receptor. So we tried to answer the question, are these receptors located in the T-tubules with L-type calcium channels or cavioli-like structure, and what the changes during hypertrophy. And also important things, because in the main things in the excitation contraction coupling main participants in L-type calcium channels, how the L-type calcium channels localize on the surface of the cardiomyocytes and what happened during the heart failure. And the third question, what the physical coupling of the L-type calcium channels with beta adrenergic receptor and how it changed in failing cells. So for this, and also this, now we start to study the localization of L-type calcium channels in atrial myocytes and the relationship between the channel localization and structure of atrial myocytes, and what the speakers yesterday discussed, and I will just really show some results of this direction. So, first of all, how and why we developed this combination of scan and FRET, because beta adrenergic receptor is very, very important receptor, but no reliable antibodies exist, because it's because the beta 1 and the beta 2 receptors, they have a ratio 70-30, and the beta 2 receptors very, very important in physiology, and potentially beta 2 receptors just J and JS coupling, double coupling, and just responsible for survival, and beta 1 receptor responsible for apoptosis, and they have the same second message cyclic AMP. And potentially no way to identify this beta adrenergic receptor, because it's no antibodies. And we just really try to combine the FRET sensors with our scanning and try to check the differences in special localization of beta adrenergic receptor on the surface, normal and failing cells. So for this, we just use the FRET sensor EPAC, and the FRET sensor which have two fluorophores, YFP and CFP, and binding domain. And the idea, when you have a cyclic AMP, when you activate receptor, cyclic AMP goes up, and these two fluorophores change their conformation. Potentially, this, if you have the receptor, you have a low FRET. Okay, so first, we infect our cardiomyocytes with this FRET sensor. And second, we scan the cardiomyocytes and we identify the area of our interest. So we identify the tubules and we identify the crest. Third, we just apply through the pipette. We put in the pipette stimulus to beta 2 receptor or to beta 1 receptor. So, and for example, if you have stimulus inside pipette, you add your stimul. If you have receptor, cyclic LP goes up, you have a low fret, you have receptor in this particular area. So what we found the beta 1 adrenergic receptor located, because this is a beautiful cardiomyocytes, and we found a very good fret response in the tubule and in the crest, and potentially beta 2 receptor we have only in the T-tubules and no any stimulus in the crest, and we check the a lot of different things, and we try to find mechanism of this, and we, because this is audience, I don't know about phosphodiesterase or many other things, but potentially this we found the involvement of PKA in this process. But what the important things we found during the heart failure, we found some sort of detabulation, and we found the beta 1 receptor still in the crest in the T-tubules, and beta 2 receptor move from the T-tubule to the crest, and in this situation we found in the pathological situation from the local signal of beta 2 receptor to the global signal to the beta 2 receptor in disease heart cells. And we found the PKA involvement, and we found in the healthy cells when we apply the local signal in the tubules, we have some sort of local distribution of beta 2 receptor. But in the failing cells, when we apply the local signal through the pipette, we have a global distribution of beta 2 receptors. And this is connected to the PKA. We check and add the peptide, which one just destroy the relationship in PKR2 subunits, and we just conclude the functional beta 2 receptor normally located exclusively in the T-tubules, and the local beta 2 receptor signaling in the T-tubules confined with the interaction with PKA molecules. And in heart failure, beta 2 receptor is distributed from the T-tubule to the crest. So potentially now we're studying a lot of things, how this, can we reverse this beta 2 receptor distribution in heart failure, but because
Could you detect a downregulation of receptors, and if so, which of them was preferentially downregulated, or do you see similar sorts of density?
Sort of density, because potentially no beta 2, it means beta 2 not downregulate, beta 1 just downregulate, beta 2 not, but very difficult to detect. You can do the only gene expression because of antibodies is not really reliable. That's why it's
quite... But with your physiology...
You can just check the same level of the beta 2 receptors, but it's only the distribution, and beta 1 receptors quite downregulated, definitely. So potentially this, because the this now a lot of things going on in the beta 2 adrenergic stimulation in our laboratory, I will just discuss about a small project and move to the L-type calcium channels. Is more people are more familiar with this part of our work in beta adrenergic stimulation. So potentially now we just study the progressive changes in cardiomyocyte structure during the myocardial infarction, and also we study the control of beta 2 response in the different myocardial region, because we found the differences in the apex and base of the heart, and also potentially this we check the way of regulation of beta 2 adrenergic receptors. So we recently found the role of the caveoli and caveolin, and potentially this we check because of course it's very, very difficult to detect the caveoli-like structure with our pipette, because it's when you have the, this one grooves, and we can just detect the caveoli with a very, very sharp pipette and with the overexpression of caveolin 3. So potentially this we found, if we have a infect the cells with the covalin-3 virus, we have a more covioli. And when we infect the cells with the dominant negative covalin, we have a less covioli. And this dominant negative covalin-3, this give you mode of the beta-2 signaling from the local to the global. And in the heart failure model of 16 weeks of coronary elongation, when we infect the covalin-3, we found the covalin-3 overexpression in felin cells give you the localized signal to the T-tubules. And we just confine the, and conclude the covalin-3 plays a crucial role for localization of beta-2 adrenergic receptor and compartments of the beta-2 signaling the T-tubule healthy cardiomyocytes. And overexpression of covalin-3 in felin myocytes can partially restore the disruption localization of this receptor. So, advantages of this scanning FRET stuff to study distribution of receptors on the surface, study the coupling between the different signaling complexes, and in combination of super-resolution patch clamp, study the coupling between the receptors and ion channels. So, my favorite part is just really super-resolution scanning patch clamp, because long time ago, this we found the patch clamp people and our technique used the glass micropipette as a sensitive probe, and we just can, and we just decided to use this pipette to patch and get the ion channel recording, but not randomly ion channel recording in the some proper areas. And a long time ago, this we just used the pipette and we just scan and see the area of our interest. And we use this pipette and we just really switch off feedback control and we form a gigaseal and patch clamp record from the particular areas. But it was very inconvenient because pipette is very small. Resistance of, of this pipette, 120 mega sometimes, 100. So, and area of the pipette is very, very small. And okay, we can just record the channels, but channels was quite a rare event, and we just work and work and got the 1, 2, 3 channels, and just we don't know what to do. And recently, this we just adapt this method, and we just really start to just guys to just first of all we scan. Second, we just really clip the pipette through the glass surface, and just after that it's we record the channels from this is a neuronal synapse. I want to show this because because this is really good movie, and you just first scan, after that you no noise, because it was a very, very good noise, sorry, because it's not my computer. And after that it's you just measure the current. Okay. Yes, sorry. What's that? Okay, so I'm very sorry, I can just continue. When I
Your message is too powerful.
I know, because it's potentially, when I have an inaugural lecture, just in the middle of the lecture, the same happened, and I just really continue, keep going, but, it was my mistake to show you neuron, because I think it's,
Julia, can I ask you a technical question?
Yeah.
How long does it take to make a scan?
Depends on the what resolution.
400 by 400 microns.
Depends of resolution, because potentially this, if you want to, minimum 9 seconds, now less than 9 seconds, but small area, less than 1 micron. If you want, for example, 10 by 10 micron, this 2 minutes, 3 minutes.
So let's say you have a cardiac cell, 30 micron roughly in length,
30 to 30. Okay, with good resolution. Okay, depends what do you want. If you want latte.
I don't know where the T-tubules are, so that.
Okay, 3-5 minutes. 3-5 minutes.
3 to 5 minutes.
3-5 minutes, because.
And what is the. Sorry.
Keep going.
What is the energy released by the pipette locally?
hole.
Because you're passing.
Depends, because again, depends. If you want to do the charge stuff, you can do it by voltage. If you want to do the pipette for peptide or something, you need to apply the pressure. Yeah, and this is depends of diameter of your pipette. This is depends of many, many different things, because you need to play. Sorry, you need to play with the shape of the pipette, because honestly, pipette is really the key figure of all this experiment, because potentially we know what we want, because if we apply for just applying the signal, this is a one diameter of the pipette, this is a one shape of the pipette. If you want to measure stiffness, for example, you need to just calculate. Every time you need to calculate diffusion, you need to calculate how local you are, and tubal, it's ideal, because this is a 200 nanometers, and between your tubal you have 2 microns. That's why this, anyway, this is local. Yeah. If you go.
So your, but your pipette is 400 nanometer.
No. How my pipette from 20 nanometers right. to 200 nanometers. My pipette is different.
So for people like us who use electrodes for very simple recordings. Or for voltage clamp, for example, we always have concerns that there are pressure tip potentials that are artifactual and causes problems in the measurements of membrane potential, ionic currents, and so on. And here we are trying to keep the pipette as still and un.
Could I continue and show you what we have, and we can discuss after this channel recording, yeah? Because this is will be channel recordings, yeah? So sorry for this neurons, because as I wanted to show neurons because it's a good noise. Now there's no noise, and just this is a cardiomyocyte, and this is a cardiomyocyte this big, and this is a sharp pipette, and this pipette is around resistance 100 something mega. After that, it's you just clip this with a special program, and you can just go. Now the diameter of your pipette 300 nanometers, 250, you cover the tubules. And after that, it's potentially you, for example, this is pipette, original pipette, and this is original scan. This is a scan after clipping, but potentially you already have a map of the tubule when you do the sharp pipette. And after that, it's you just can cover and you can just measure the channels. And what we found here, the majority of L-type calcium channels located in the T-tubules. And the some channels located in the crest, and this is with agreement with the Steve Hauser, who said this channels in the, let's say, cavioli of the ventricular cells, they're not really important for excitation contraction coupling. And we just check the, again, our model of heart failure, 16 weeks of coronary relaxation, and we found there very, very interesting things. So we found there we have a different distribution on functional L-type calcium channels on the sarcolemma of normal and failing red ventricular cardiomyocytes. So the same, for example, this is a scan on the failing heart cells when you still have some T-tubules, you still have a crest, but the occurrence of L-type calcium channels, this is absolutely different. So we have a lot of channels in the crest, and potentially this compare with the control cells, but what more interesting, we have a different characteristics of these channels. So we check not only the failing red cardiomyocytes, also this we use the human failing cardiomyocytes from the different patients. We use the cardiomyocytes from dilated cardiomyopathy and from ischemic heart disease. And potentially this is what we found. We found in human cardiomyocytes, in the and we also use the control as unused donor hearts. And we found during the heart failure, you have huge abnormal channels with abnormal open probability only in the crest. And we just found that these channels we can close, use the blocker for the CAM kinase 2, And we just also see this this phosphorylation of these channels and this CAM kinase 2 phosphorylation responsible for just close these channels, potentially this with the different blockers to the CAM kinase 2, we close these abnormal channels. But what more interesting, because I'm not modeling person, I just really show you the model from Natalia Troyanova, and I just cannot comment, I can just only say as a biologist, that she took our data from redistribution of L-type calcium channels, and she just do the simulation, and she found the when the channels redistribute from the T-tubule to the crest, we have severe severe arrhythmia and re-entry, and this is just I cannot comment on this because I'm not a mathematician, but potentially this is, for me, it's very cool. So small microdomain changes, small microdomain relocalization led to the severe arrhythmia in the heart failure. So not measured. So potentially this is all simulation.
Yes, this is also measured much longer in failure.
Yes, yes,
is
yes.
That confirmed experimentally.
Yes, yes, of course.
Julia, I have another question. A
yes,
or question.
Of so course, but it's not okay. Yes.
So when you lower your pipette into looking for a calcium channel,
okay,
you lower your pipette into a crest, onto a crest.
Mm-hmm.
You measure a single channel recording.
Mm-hmm.
When you do it into a pit or into mm-hmm. a T-tubule,
mm-hmm.
what are you actually measuring?
My feeling, this is some sort of mouth, and we can just go further, this 200 nanometers, 300 nanometers, and potentially this, when we clamp, we just, I think it's, this is not from single tubule, I think it's in the mouth of the T-tubules, and, but you have a really, actually difference when you have a control versus the heart failure. This is a big question, because it's what the area we are doing, that's why this I'm really supposed to do load the T-tubules with the anapsis, for example, and check the individual T-tubules, and after that try to clamp how we clamp the this synapse of the neuron. That's why this, I'm talking about mouth of the T-tubules. Of course, I'm not, this is, big question, but potentially this, we can regulate this. And this is some sort of about the functional, because potentially maybe you have a protein in this particular areas, but it's channels not functional, what I can.
So do you think that in your recordings that you were actually able to record from an intact T-tubule as well, or just from a sort of a pit?
I'm thinking about it because I'm thinking about combining the two pipettes when you can just really activate and measure when you just try to isolate these tubules. It's quite difficult. Honestly, I tried to load single tubules because what we found, when you have a control red cardiomyocytes, when you just load through the pipette, this dye, you can just see in control variant your opening correspond to the tubule. When you have some sort of heart failure, sometimes you have a different abnormal situation, you don't have a opening from one point of view, from another point of view you don't have these tubules go through entire cardiomyocytes. That's why this is quite, I don't know, it's some sort of, this is some sort of limitation about this mouth. I know this, yeah. So, okay, so let's do this, I have time. So, another things, we tried to check the atrial myocytes. And atrial myocytes, yesterday talk was very interesting about T-tubules in atrial myocytes. And of course, there, if ventricular myocytes more or less homogeneous, but not very homogeneous, but we have a difference between left ventricle myocytes, right ventricle, apex, base, but atrial myocytes in red very, very have a very, very heterogeneous population. So what we found? We found in atrial red myocytes three type of different cardiomyocytes, with the good agonized tubules, and with the just not good AVMS tubules and empty cells. And we just really see the differences between left atria and right atria, and potentially this very difficult to study atrial myocytes because we try to just identify these three groups, but very difficult. And now, for example, we study the beta.
What is the staining?
This is ANOPS.
ANOPS.
This is ANOPS, and this is tissue and tissue WG8 staining. In the tissue slices, this is just atria, and we found the most structured cells in left atria.
You don't see any striation in atria?
Yes, 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 some of them. This is a percent cells with organized tubules, with the disorganized tubules, with the absent tubules, potentially difference with the left atria and right atria. And now we try to match all our results to the different cells. Is so difficult. We just really use for FRET measurement a lot of transgenic mice, and we just do the whole atria and try to do the FRET through entire tissue and check the different cells. But what? Oh.
Questions. Sorry, I think what's the animal you are using?
Rat. This is rat, but we have human. I will speak about human.
Perfect. Yeah. So it's just to know. So how do you define? So when you make the measurement, you have to decide how do you find organism is organized. I mean, how do you? What specific measure you take?
Oh, we have a specific program when you have a transverse index. Transverse tubule to the axial tubule, I will show you, and potentially this we have a balance between transverse and axial, and now this we start to measure the new one. This is our old paper. We just really see the this is organized because as we measure density, regularity, and now this we measure balance between axial and transverse. I will show you how we measure. But okay, so we are talking about channels, sorry. So this one is several groups. It's very, very difficult. But what interesting, if in ventricular myocytes, we have a L-type calcium channels in the T-tubules majority, and not a lot to the crest, in the atrial myocytes, you see this red atrial myocytes. It's a who made this naughty tubules. So in atrial myocytes, we have an equal amount of channels in the T-tubules and in the crest. This is a human atrial myocytes. We just have a human atrial myocytes from sinus rhythm and atrial fibrillation patients, but this is a controlled sinus rhythm. So potentially when we check the occurrence of this L-type calcium channels, we found the equally distributed between the T-tubule and the crest. But what interesting, in atrial myocytes, cavioli play really very important role. 5 times more cavioli in atrial myocytes compared with the ventricle myocytes. And what we found when we just do this dirty stuff with the cyclodextrin and deplete cholesterol, we just found there no channels in the crest in atrial myocytes. And we just also check the special blocker from Steve Housel laboratory, REM, CAF, novel LTCC blocker, which selectively just traffic to the cavioli, inhibit the L-type calcium channels with the signaling microdomains. And we just confirm there are a lot of channels sitting in the cavioli in atrial myocytes, and we found there potentially this, we provide the first evidence for existence two distinct subpopulation in functional channels and red and human atrial myocytes with their biophysical properties modulation in heart failure in the microdomain specific manner. So we have a cavioli located channels and potentially this tubus location channels in atrial myocytes. And what just advantages, study distribution of ion channels, record ion channels, subcellular structures, and biologically active molecules may apply through the pipette. But now we are doing the very, very interesting work, study the coupling between L-type calcium channels and beta-adrenergic receptor when we apply our stimulus through the pipette and record the changes in the by physical characteristic of intact calcium channels. And we just have a lot of future directions, and I think it's quite interesting because we're just really looking for the some signalosomes, including in the signal cyclic AMP and phosphodiesterase activity, and potentially this we check the L-type calcium channels distribution in the different patient cells, dilated cardiomyopathy, with LVAD patients, ischemic heart disease with LVAD patient. And this is just some sort of our direction. And I want to show just example of angle scan things, but this is just part of my work and part of work of Mario Delmar. But what interesting is we try to just record the sodium channels from intercalated disc, and we found that all just functional sodium channels exist in the big clusters. And this is really very important because potentially this very difficult to detect the intercalated disc stuff. So, okay, so I think it's we have a lot of questions to answer, and we just potentially this can just use the scanning and conduct microscopy technique with the different other technique to study a lot of cardiac disease. And this is my lab. During the meeting, we discuss how big microdomains are. And this is just my laboratory, and this is Mark's lab, who died 2 years ago, and he just really was very helpful in our work and just inspired me to do this work. And thank you for your attention. Yeah. Yeah.
So in the rat atrium compared to rat ventricle, what is the difference in percentage density of T tubules?
Sorry?
Ventricle and
atrium. Rat ventricle and rat atrium. Okay. So
10%
No. Because in atria we have a population only 10% in left atria with the good developed T tubules. And you have a population what Stefan Leonard named the axial, because potentially this you can say this is disorganized. That's why I'm doing the some sort of the measurement of axial transverse population. And ventricular myocytes, okay, control, you have all myocytes with the T-tubules, but for example, the apex different from base myocytes. In base myocytes, you have a density higher than apex. And okay, left, you have more organized than right, but percent is very high. And right atria, we not find any good organized cells. So it's just really this related to what you discussed yesterday.
So when you see T-tubules in a rat atrial cell, mm-hmm. how much compared to a ventricle? A high density, a normal high density ventricular cell, is it
normal
5%,
high density?
10%?
So we have again calculation density. I think it's we have the good, this 10% have a, let's say, S density 35, 40 is the absolute value, yeah. Yeah?
So it seems like you have a whole bunch of really amazing techniques. Can't follow all of them. You're observing changes mm-hmm. that happen in heart failure in a number of different. Can you make up a story about how you think those changes are occurring? So like, what's the sequence of events that leads to those changes? And it doesn't have to be anything real.
I see,
You know, is there any way that you can imagine that this is happening?
It's very, you know, this is the same question, what the first echo or chicken, because what the first, for example, changes of morphology or changes in signaling or changes.
Well, just make up any story.
First of all, this, yeah. You have some sort of detabulations, and just this detabulation led you to the just structural changes in these small complexes, and these changes in the small complexes give you the changes in the function of the cellular level, and the changes in the function of the cellular level led you to the changes in the whole heart level.
No, but here you do the ligation, or whatever. And then what happens?
Okay, so potentially, I think because it's, we follow all this heart failure from the beginning, several weeks and 8 weeks and 16 weeks. First of all, this you disturb this. So you have a density of the T-tubules and you have a regularity of the T-tubules. First, you lost the regularity of the T-tubules, yeah? How?
Why?
How? Because its T-tubules became less regular. How?
I mean, what's transducing what?
May I interject?
Yeah, okay.
Sure.
Yeah?
There's work by Robert Shaw. Uh-huh. Shows that the T-tubules are an outgrowth from the cavioli on the surface membrane radially in, and that there's a particular trafficking factor called BIN1 that attaches to the L-type calcium channel and traffics L-type calcium channels along the T-tubule. It's a very beautiful data. And so in order to form a T-tubule, this mechanism has to be active, and in heart failure apparently it fails. So your findings with CAF3 and L-type calcium channels is in line with this concept as well. It's quite consistent. What I was wondering is, when you see changes in L-type calcium channels in the T-tubules versus the crest,
mm-hmm.
can you verify this by immunohistochemistry, by taking sections and looking at shifts in by antibody detection? Because the antibodies to the L-type calcium channels are quite robust.
Okay, but it's, yes, we did. Because potentially this, we found a high open probability, and this related to the B2 subunits of L-type, and we just confirmed this in the situation with the relocation. We have more beta 2 subunits.
So you have confirmation?
Yes.
Can I go back to my question mm-hmm. about pressure tip potentials mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. on electrodes? Because mm-hmm. this is a very persistent problem for voltage clampers or mm-hmm. even a recording of membrane potential, and we're dealing with different types of electrodes. But the sensitivity of the tip to lateral pressure mm-hmm. is quite robust, and I don't see that this problem disappears when you have an electrode tip that's 20 nanometer versus 400 nanometer.
The problem is, of course, it's no chance to get something with 20 nanometers if you don't know, if you know location, and of course you get sure. the chance.
Because
we go vertically, and sure. potentially they're very, very easy to get a seal vertically, much easier than do this way.
I'm not talking about the actual patch clamping. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the scanning data.
Okay.
Where the electrode is moving.
Yeah.
In two dimensions
okay.
across the surface.
Okay.
And so as it moves and makes either close contact or
No, because it's because
it's
we just
pressure tip potential.
Yeah, because we just really keep the distance, and potentially we never touch an object.
Okay.
And that's why this, because potentially this we go this loop, because when current drop in the some measurements just pipe it automatically go up and
rises
just,
away in order mm-hmm. to maintain a constant
yeah, yeah.
a constant resistance between
yes,
the
yes,
two.
Yes,
okay.
yes. And that's why this, we don't have this problem.
To go back to the Leon's question, to do logically why things happen and how they happen. So first, in the atrial, small percentage of cells that do develop some regular structures, is there any correlation? Are those cells bigger, wider compared to the other?
These cells are bigger than empty cells. Empty cells is just smaller.
So they're and wider, or they're wider, generally bigger?
Potentially they're wider, but again, this is not...
So you develop T-tubules
when we have a wider... Yeah. Compare with the atrials, which one they have a very, very narrow,
And the sequence of events, how in heart failure you start losing the regularity, could it be that it has to do with slips in the chondrocyte structure?
It can be from this protein, what you said about BIN1, but potentially gentofilin, for example, during the heart failure, the gentofilin is down-regulated, and probably this, because gentofilin is one of the protein that confirms the stability of the T-tubules, and a lot of factors, BIN1 also, and cavalin-3,
does the signaling cascade?
And the signaling cascade
I'm saying, could it be something much more direct, mechanical, just...
Maybe these signalosomes just really detaching just because it's, I think it's, for example, cavioli get these signalosomes and T-tubules have signalosomes. When you have some problem with the stabilization of T-tubules, you have some sort of complex and this complex cannot be stable anymore. That's all.
Yeah?
Two questions. The first thing is that it makes sense that the larger cells need structure, right? Because the diffusion cannot go so far with smaller ones. So I don't know the mechanism for how they know that they have to do it. But the question now was going about what's the origin, right? So if you have measurements of atrial fibrillation remodeling, right? You have a specific timing of remodeling. So you would be able to take data from different stages of atrial human patients with different stages of the remodeling, you will be able to maybe to know what misses first, whether it's the closing of the LCC. So do you have data like
not
that?
Not yet, but we are just collecting. It's very, very difficult problem with atrial, big problem with atrial fibrillation patients, because when we have a transplant from the failing, you have a heart, and you just have a lot of cells. When you have an appendage from this atrial patient, you just very, very tiny, and we need to have at least a piece what we can isolate the cells, and this is something.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I have a comment about that. There is a reasonably good dog model for atrial fibrillation.
Okay.
And you can control it, and you can measure it at different times.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of brings me to a question I had for you, which is, you choose a 16-week post-MI model. Any particular reason that you go 16 weeks? Because the heart failure is pretty well developed after 4.
Because it's really failing this model what we're using, and all our changes what we found, this is some sort of, we start with this model because in this particular stage we have all these differences, because now this we check in from the 4 weeks, 8 weeks, and 16 weeks, and you have some sort of trend, and this is failing. Yeah.
Well, actually, that sort of goes back to what Leanne was saying. How does this all develop? And if you looked earlier, you might actually see some things in between.
I think it's just important things to check all this stage to the heart failure. Yeah, and I will think about this.
Which I think is actually quite important, because one of the reasons that I do what I do is I want to know what's going on during heart failure development, since my view is that T-tubule loss actually causes heart failure. To look at the extreme end of heart failure is actually not as interesting, because basically everything is so screwed up at that point that whatever you measure, you're going to conclude that that was the cause of heart failure. But if you look during the development, you're going to see a very different profile.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the question for the your circulation 2016 paper on that simulation one.
Okay.
Yeah, not the simulation.
Okay.
The question for So you basically, based on your measurements, say your calcium channel relocalized in the crest, so you lose calcium because you lose T2 bills, so the more channels is localized in the crest. Mm-hmm. So in the computer model, actually, how you model that, I know that they remove the calcium dependent in the duration mm-hmm. of the channel at the crest. So the question is, this actually proved in the experiment. Actually, we did simulations using the cell with the special location, the cell that Johannes showed mm-hmm. yesterday. We have these special structures. You, mm-hmm. you can put the cells, you know, without the SR, go with it, just a pure calcium channel there. Mm-hmm. It seems to us is the calcium from the calcium channel is already strong enough to inactivate the channel. You don't need a calcium release from the SR. So that says if the channel is in the crest, we think that the channel kinetics shouldn't change that much versus the channel is in the T2-bill. But the simulation actually is removed that the calcium dependent inactivation mm-hmm. is actually increased the calcium current a lot in that simulation. Mm-hmm. So the question is, this point proved in the experiment. Do you have experimental evidence for this?
Yes, potentially this we check the...
I know that potential you have the channel redistribution.
But
the kinetics changed.
Okay. So potentially this we have...
Yeah, we'll redistribute the channels
but
in the
this
model. We cannot see that.
I see. I don't know, because it's what we check. We check the AED, this in the cellular level, and we prove this and just...
Mm-hmm. Right. The redistribution calcium channel, no problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no data to show that actually the kinetics of the calcium
part
is changed.
I don't know,
Julia, we can't. Your slide with this distribution of the structured chaotic and empty cells, space distribution. Mm-hmm. Two questions, actually. Mm-hmm. One is how many rats were murdered to obtain this distribution? First question, was it just from one rat or how many? How consistent is your data?
This one?
Yes, this one. In the bottom.
Not less than 5, 6, 10, because we have a group.
You had a group, it was
one.
Consistent.
Of course, yeah.
That's very interesting. And another question is, sorry for the question. You said that you identified two functional calcium mm-hmm. channels, which one was structural and another one was...
Incavelli.
Yes. In this, how to formulate my question. Did you observe transition between... So could it be that structural change into... No, probably not. But the percentage of structural and percentage of ionic kind of current support functional channels, does it modify in heart failure? No? Sorry if it's not clear.
This is not heart failure, this is atrial.
Yes,
and
that is next step. That is spatial distribution. What I'm trying to
about. So we did. Yeah, I understand.
Did
I understand.
The transition between structural, chaotic, empty.
We didn't really, we are doing this now. This is just potentially this, unfortunately, we, from one point of view, we found that these three groups, and another point is we just really mapped the channels. And now, unfortunately
okay.
not. No, we not touch this. And we are doing it.
Is,
now.
Could it be that in heart failure, for example, well-organized tubes, T-tubules become chaotic, become absent, or is it developmental thing? Is it heart failure or development?
It's difficult to say in atrial, especially because we are doing this now.
How
about sodium calcium exposure? You focus on alpha calcium current.
Yes, we didn't do this, so we can do it, of course.
It's doable. Could
it's doable.
From our modeling work, Southern Catholic Cathedral is extremely important because that's what pumps all the calcium out, mm-hmm, comes mm-hmm. in from the Elthe mm-hmm. calcium current.
Mm-hmm. So this is, yeah, it's possible.
If the LCC is moved to the boundary and the exchangers are somewhere else, mm-hmm. the whole homeostasis system will change.
Yeah, I think it's, yeah, it's possible, why not?
Yeah, yeah, some data actually from Canfield since very old data, and some from the England group, the T2B, what is his name of that? They measured the distribution of this gene. I think that they annex information on, yeah, in this part.